It's a pleasure to welcome so many people here today, a large number of members, and I think an even larger number of guests. I'll put in the usual plug. We'd love to see some of those guests become members. It only costs you $10 a year, and you get a large number of very interesting meetings for that small subscription. The main purpose of our meeting today is to welcome here Mr. Eugenie Guccione from the USA, who is editor of Mining Engineering, a magazine which will be familiar to all of you here today who are in the mining profession. Gene, I think you prefer to be called, is that correct?
Right.
Right. Is a chemical engineer by profession, and perhaps a journalist by adoption might be the right way to describe it. He's become deeply involved in economics in the last few years, and in particular, economics as they affect the mineral industry. He's a director of the Committee for Monetary Research and Education, which perhaps illustrates his deep interest in international financial affairs and industry money-raising activities. He's an expert on taxation and the way in which it affects the mining industry, and his writings have indicated his deep concern about the long-term effects on the natural resource industries which government taxation has had over the last 10 years, and it is increasingly having as time goes on. In particular, he's emphasised the effects of things with which we're all familiar, of course, depletion allowances and so forth, and the general lack of them in Australia particularly. I think we might describe him also as a realist in environmental matters. He's worked hard to introduce some reality and common sense into the emotionalism that's surrounded the conservation, pollution, etc. issues. And these also have been the subject of a number of publications which he has made. Whether he succeeded in introducing any element of common sense into this emotional atmosphere in the States, perhaps he'll tell us in the course of his talk. The subject of his talk is real and counterfeit money and the effect which the counterfeit side of it has on international financing. Gene.
Thank you, Dr. Welsh. I saw a lady, so I will say lady and gentle persons. That's the way to address people these days, of a wooden lip. To borrow a phrase from the Democratic presidential nominee in America, Jimmy Carter, quote, "Before I start my speech, I want to say something." First, the views that we're about to hear my own, and they don't necessarily reflect the views of the Society of Mining Engineers, or AIME, or any other organization I happen to be associated with. Number two, my contempt for politics is distributed with equanimity to all political parties. And that is because just as there is no Republican way or Democratic way of sweeping the streets, so I don't think there is either a liberal way or a labor way of mining. Science is one thing. Applied science is one thing. Politics is another. So that's the reason for my contempt. In fact, if I had my way, I put government in charge of only two things, sex and music. I might think, what the hell has that got to do? Government with sex and music, I best explain in terms of this little story that involved three miners. who wanted to set up a corporation. Now, the first miner was about 6'6" and weighed about 300 pounds. The other guy was about 6'2" but about 250 pounds. And then there was Shorty, fellow about my size and weight. Well, the big guy, the 300-pound guy, says, well, I have 66% of the stock. I'll be chairman of the board. And then the other 6'2" guy, who weighs 250 pounds, says, well, I have the other 33% of the stock. I'll be president of the company. And then Shorty says, well, what about me? What am I going to do? So the two guys look at him and say, I'll tell you what, we'll put you in charge of sex and music. And he says, what the hell is that? The two guys look at each other and look at him and say, tell you what, when we need your fucking advice, we'll whistle for you. Gives you a little indication of the dissatisfaction and frustration that all of us in America, and I'm sure all of you in Australia, feel towards our protectors, either in Washington or Canberra. For Americans, the biggest resentment against government is ventilated during the month of April. We call it the April Blues, or the IRS Rites of Spring, when the sacrificial taxpayers are put on the sacrificial stone and slaughtered to death. And so we filed our tax returns in April with a great deal of cursing, because we had finally come to the recognition that it took the United States 186 years from 1776 until 1962 for the federal government to reach an annual spending level of $100 billion. That's what it was during the first year of the Kennedy administration. But it took only 9 years to double federal expenditures to $200 billion. And then it only took 4 years, from 71 to 75, to double again federal expenditures to the current level of $420 billion a year. Meanwhile, the deficits have piled up to the sky. So we have come to recognize that the liquidity crisis is staggering, which means we're all hard up for cash, and that's primarily because of the increasing tax burden. You have all heard, at least from such sources as the Brookings Institution, I don't know what is the equivalent in Australia, but this is the kind of outfit that tells you, well, you see, the federal government and government as a whole doesn't spend that much money because it only takes one-third of the gross national product, which is very nice as far as it goes, but I would like to have somebody tell me how on earth I could pay my taxes out of the gross national product. The fact is that you and I pay our taxes out of our gross income. So you have to look at taxation in terms of percentage of the gross national income. And here it goes. In 1950, in the United States, taxation, both local, state and federal, was taking only 28% of the gross national income. By 1960, it was taking 36%. Today, it is taking 43% of the nation's income. Now, if you add to 43 the 8% that is stolen from us for inflation, we have come to recognize that what Uncle Sam is taking out of our pocket is at least 51 cents of every dollar earned. Despite of the fact that this has been the greatest ripoff, or if you will, the greatest redistribution of wealth in recorded history, government has not eliminated poverty. Unemployment is increasing. And the American economy, which used to be the marvel of the world, has been lobotomized by government action into a deformed cretin that suffers unemployment and inflation simultaneously, something that Keynesians never thought would happen. And so, come April, We all curse because, among other things, after subsidizing illegitimacy through so-called federal aid to dependent children for the past generation, we have now come to recognize that we live in a world full of bastards. Since I am not an economist by profession, but by avocation, I'm going to look at the monetary situation with the same innocence, or if you will, stupidity, of the child in the story of the emperor's clothes, who said out loud, "The emperor is naked." To start, let me give you the good news first. I'm sure you will all be happy to know that the US dollar and the Australian dollar are still in better shape than the Brazilian Cruzeiro, the British pound, and the Indian rupee. Now that I've given you the good news, let me give you the bad news. In principle, what is going on today in monetary and fiscal policy is quite similar to what was going on 200 years ago, or 500 years ago, or 3,000 years ago. You see, in ages past, many centuries ago, a government would seize gold and try to palm off bronze or copper coins to its citizens. The modern method, of course, is more sophisticated. It consists of palming off paper after seizing gold. So there is nothing new in today's governmental attitude toward gold or any other form of wealth. In fact, if there is one conclusion that can be drawn after about 30 centuries of monetary history, it is simply this. You can obtain wealth by earning it, which is fairly difficult, or by seizing it, which is much easier, and which is the favorite method of government. Of course, if you seize personally, individually, somebody else's property, that is called theft. If government does it, it is called taxation or nationalization. Now, at least since the Renaissance, the frauds and thefts of monetary history have been interwoven with a new element, lunacy. You see, the alchemists of the Middle Ages searched in vain for the philosopher's stone that would change lead into gold. The alchemists of today, sometimes known as, quote-unquote, the new economists, have not found the philosopher's stone either, but they have found a substitute, the Keynesian stone. It turns gold into paper, which is all right. You see, paper is a worthwhile commodity, unfortunately. As Ludwig von Mises has pointed out, today's government is the only institution that can take a worthwhile commodity like paper, slap some ink on it, and so make it worthless. Case in point, the US dollar, the Australian dollar, and so on down the line. The dollar is bankrupt. The emperor is naked. Virtually every currency today, with perhaps the exception of the Swiss franc, is a fiat currency, which means a currency backed only by the word of politicians. And you all know how good that is. Consequently, various governments have endorsed the mystic notion that wealth is created by issuing billions of little pieces of paper with the portrait of some national hero on it. And you see, that wouldn't be too bad if it didn't cause international complications. It seems that by divine right, a government, any government, can steal freely from its own citizens by inflating its fiat currency. Unfortunately, when it attempts to use its fiat currency to grab the assets of citizens of other nations, then that government is likely to get clobbered, because when confidence in your currency disappears, then other nations want to be paid in values, in real goods, in real wealth, not in pieces of paper. So, no government can tamper with the measurement of value, that is, no government can inflate its currency and get away with it indefinitely in the realm of international trade. You see, a fiat currency is a claim by government against the assets of its own citizens only, meaning it cannot be a claim against the assets of other countries, as things now stand without currency convertibility in some actual specie. The US dollar, the British pound, the Italian lira, and so on down the line, cannot continue to be indefinitely to serve as Western claims against our oil. The problem that the industrialized nations have had with the Arab nations is a very, very good example of the effect of counterfeit money in international affairs. Right off the start, let me say that I do admire the Arab people and culture, but I don't admire Arab governments because I have nothing but contempt for totalitarian regimes of any kind. Having said that, let's see what happened. In the early 1940s, the Arabs expropriated the oil fields of American and European companies. While it is true that the Arabs stole from us, it is also true that then we stole from them. Thanks mostly to the American Congress desire of wanting to give cheap and abundant energy to the American consumer, the price of crude oil, FOB, Ras Tanura, Persian Gulf, was manipulated downwards from $2.50 per barrel in 1947 to less than $1.50 per barrel in 1970. During this 23-year period, therefore, the Arabs saw their only export commodity plunge in value. Meanwhile, they were being paid for their oil with quickly depreciating fiat currencies, which, aside from the fact that they were being de facto inconvertible into gold, were also inconvertible into strategic technology and into the kind of weaponry that the Arab wants. In addition, at the expense of their own Arab-Palestinian residents, the Arabs were forced to swallow the establishment of an Israeli state and then witness a steady flow of U.S. military and economic aid to their new unwelcome neighbor. Now, my sympathies are with the Israeli, but that's absolutely beside the point. Considering the Arab plight, it was quite predictable. And even I predicted it in April of 1972, 18 months before it occurred, that the Arabs would react. And indeed, they reacted in 73. In October of 73, they formed a cartel and quadrupled their oil prices. And suddenly, everybody discovered the energy crisis, even though many of us in industry have been predicting that energy crisis since the late 1950s. But you see, that energy crisis was a made-in-Washington disaster that began at least as early as 1938, when Congress passed the Natural Gas Act. The Arabs did not cause either our energy crisis or our monetary and economic problems. We're doing a superb job of cutting our own throats long before the Arabs set up their OPEC cartel. Now, when inflation keeps eroding the value of your currency, the nations holding your fiat money become increasingly nervous. They don't want that money that they are holding to lose value. In other words, they don't want to be stuck with your IOUs. And they can use a number of tactics to bring you to your senses. Creditor nations, for example, can dramatically curtail their trade with you, and they can raise all sorts of back-breaking export-import controls. Or they can unload their reserves of your inflated money into the foreign exchange markets, thereby converting your dirty float into a dirty sink. Or they can cut you off their markets. Or, as a last resort, creditor nations can ship back to you your paper and insist that you meet your obligations by paying in gold, which is what is happening with Italy and Portugal, and by making either political or trade concessions. So, unless you shape up and stop inflating, you will eventually remain isolated from world trade. When that happens, that nationalism and mercantilism take over with a vengeance. Your reserves of foreign exchange disappear very quickly, which means you can no longer buy the finished goods or raw materials that are more economically produced abroad. As a consequence, you are forced to rechannel whatever little capital, manpower, and other resources you have in order to produce domestically and at a much higher cost whatever you had formerly imported at a fraction of the cost. So your entire national economy is dislocated. You no longer enjoy the benefits of the worldwide division of labor. Very soon, many companies that depended on foreign trade go bankrupt. Many people lose their jobs. The prices of some commodities go sky high. We've seen that with oil. While the prices of other commodities plunges down, as we have seen that in copper, for instance, and in some of the agricultural commodities, which of course makes the miners very unhappy, and the farmers very unhappy because the farmers are now stuck with megatons of produce that they can no longer export. Then the labor unions get into the action. They go on the war path, seeking higher wages and quote-unquote job security. And demagogues of all tribes, in and out of Canberra, in and out of Washington, mount in their soap boxes. Profits decline, at first very gently. And then this trickle of red ink becomes a flood in all the corporate annual reports. The stock market that has been going to the dogs all this time suddenly and unexpectedly crashes. Business and bank failures multiply. Millions of people are out of work. The savings of other people are wiped out overnight. Now, of course, I'm not describing current conditions, although if the shoe fits, wear it. I'm describing what happened during the Great Depression between 1929 and 1939. Now, thanks to the magnificent handling of monetary and economic affairs, the various monetary authorities tell us that such a disaster will never happen again. Famous first words. The United States is a debtor nation. Now, international debts can be settled either by a transfer of real wealth from debtor nation to creditor nation, or and by major political concessions that eventually bring about a drastically altered balance of power among nations. And all the arguments from Washington to the contrary, and Henry Kissinger notwithstanding, will not change this fact one iota. Now, to look now at the effect of counterfeit money domestically, you have some sheets that are best around because we can show some slides here. Let's look at the effect that counterfeit money has in the domestic economy, namely inflation, wage and price controls, and deflation. All inflations have a common symptom, and that's high prices. Mathematically, the price is just a ratio. It's X amount of money per unit of goods and services. So you can look at that slide number 4, here it is. Look at that with inflation, for instance, $2.95 for a pound of steak, that's how much it costs in New York. $2 an hour for a babysitter, and so on, you get the point. So you can express the general price level as a time function of the ratio of the available money supply to the available supply of goods and services. Now, think of this. Without obstacles to trade and production, the supply of goods and services, that's the denominator of that ratio, would increase, and if the supply of money, or at least its rate of growth, were held constant, we would then see at least a stabilization in the general price level and ultimately a decrease in price, which means your money gets appreciated much more. Now, this has held true in many products and in many industrial commodities because that history is one of slowly decreasing prices across the years, thanks to technology and in spite of government. However, what's happened in the past circa 30 or 40 years has been the exactly opposite. All of the central bankers have been increasing the money supply in order to finance government deficits, while the legislators and the national bureaucracies have constantly been concocting new schemes to curtail the freedom of trade and production. So you have the situation where the numerator of that general price level keeps increasing, while the denominator gets smaller and smaller. The result is that the general price level has no way to go but up, and sometimes at a much faster rate than the rate of increase in the money supply. When that happens, inflation becomes uncontrollable. And we almost reached that point in 1974 in the States. Fortunately, thanks to Arthur Burns, chairman of the American Federal Reserve System, thanks to Alan Greenspan, who's chairman of the President Council of Economic Advisors, the Ford administration was able, by exercising its veto power on all sorts of crackpot spending schemes, was able to slash in half the rate of inflation from 14% in 1974 to the current level of about 7%. However, if Jimmy Carter gets elected, my guess is that inflation will again reach the double-digit level, and since history gives us the pattern, this time it will probably be somewhere between the 15 to 20% a year. Great. And that time, this time, inflation could very well become uncontrollable. Why is that? Well, let me give you a retrospect, a little history about what happened in 1974, when the wholesale price index, which is the leading indicator which eventually gets reflected itself in the consumer price level, increased by roughly 20%. Now, the biggest purchaser of goods and services is the government. It buys wholesale. Now, if government wants to buy this year the same amount of goods and services that it bought last year, it needs at least 20% more money. In fact, in 1974, William Simon, Secretary of the Treasury, said that he had to raise in the next 16 months $80 billion to cover the projected budget deficits up to this year, 76. So the question was, how, in a situation like this, would the government go about raising the loot? Well, they could try selling government bonds. The trouble is that drains an awful lot of capital from the money markets, and the result is a liquidity squeeze that plunges the housing industry into a panic and that restricts the capital available for capital-intensive industries such as mining. Now, both Alan Greenspan and William Simon, to some extent Joey Ford, realize that, and we have stressed time and time again that government cannot keep on siphoning off funds away from the capital markets without creating a liquidity squeeze. Now, to give an idea of how bad things are, in 1973, government borrowing totaled 63% of the capital market. In 75, government borrowing totaled 80% of the capital market. This leaves only 20% for the so-called private sector. This is beginning to happen again. You see a rise in the prime interest rate, which means everybody in the States is right now screaming its full head off. And the conclusion will be, as it always has been, that government will continue to raise a good portion of the loot it needs by debt monetization via credit expansion, which translated in English means by printing more counterfeit money, which of course will pave the way to the next stupendous jump in the consumer price level, which will mean eventually that there will be more shortages. Because you see, under ordinary conditions of state-organized plunder, a fiat currency is a claim by the government against existing goods and services. But when that fiat currency gets inflated, it then becomes a claim against future goods and services, against things that haven't yet been produced, as a result of which you have a shortage. Shortage of equipment, of materials, of fuels, of capital, which is something we have already seen for the 1970s, plus the shortage of shelter, food, and jobs that we are witnessing right now, and that will worsen for the rest of this decade. Ultimately, we see the worst shortage of all, the shortage of jobs, or if you will, the abundance of unemployment. That is known as a depression. And every two-bit politician works overtime planning new expenditures to relieve the suffering of the masses. And the fact is that the depression is not an isolated phenomenon. It is a logical consequence of inflation. The job shortage that occurs is part and parcel of the government-created boom and bust syndrome. Now, very briefly, to show you how the inflationary process works out, look at that slide number one, there it is. This is just a very quick and sloppy way to see how credit is generated. In mathematical jargon, credit expansion is a reciprocal function of reserve requirements. For instance, if the reserve is 20%, then credit expansion is the reciprocal of 20% or 5. In other words, let's see how this works. Suppose that the reserve requirements of the banking system, commercial banking system, is 20%. This means that for each $100 deposit, the bank must hold at least $20 in reserve and can loan out $80. When that $80 is loaned out and ends up in another bank, that second bank must keep 20% of $80, which is $16, on reserve and can only loan out the difference, which is $64. Now, the ultimate result of all of this deposit and loan transactions is that the original $100 deposit is created throughout the entire banking circle. At least $500 of liabilities equivalent to $100 in reserves and $400 in loans. Now, that will give you a little indication of the kind of nightmare problems that occur when your borrowers can't repay the interest of the loan, let alone the principal. And when you think of the all of those undeveloped countries that are in hock up to their eyeballs, and you have First National's Bank of Chicago, First National Bank of New York, Chase Manhattan Bank, and all of the Bank of America that are holding the bag with all of these bankrupt currencies. You can see the kind of unwinding, economic and financial unwinding that is in the scene. Now, you might think that that is sort of a Ponzi scheme, as we call it in the States, but bear this in mind, just as there is nothing immoral or illegal about a corporation issuing commercial paper, as long as that commercial paper is fully backed by assets, real assets, there is nothing immoral or illegal about issuing paper money, provided that it is fully backed either by gold or by goods actually produced. Productivity has to go up. So there is nothing immoral or illegal either about fractional reserve banking, if you know how to keep your books and if you lend money judiciously. After all, it was fully convertible paper money and fractional reserve banking that financed the Industrial Revolution. Now, when it comes to debt, the thing that you have to bear in mind is this, that private debts are self-liquidating. Government debts are self-perpetuating. Today, the mechanism of inflation in the United States, in Australia, and all countries, is triggered by the so-called process of debt monetization, which means new money substitutes are created whenever the Treasury runs a deficit, which means all the time. So whenever the Treasury needs cash, it issues Treasury or government bonds. These bonds are government IOUs to be repaid at some future date out of taxation, in theory. When these bonds are bought by the central bank, they are considered as bank deposits, meaning they are treated as if they were actual assets or gold. So they wind up in the liability deposit structure, that's the left column in that slide number two, and there they generate new bank reserves and therefore new credit through loans and ultimately new paper money, which means new claims, additional claims against non-existing goods and services. The foregoing process, if continued long enough, will destroy a currency. Now, I'm going to shock all of you. First of all, is there a solution to the monetary and to the monetary and economic problems that we have? And the answer is, of course, yes, it is. If government does only what it is supposed to do, which is first, codifying and administering unequivocal and objective laws by means of which financial disputes among citizens can be settled, and second, by protecting each citizen from another citizen's use of force or financial dealing, and that's all. Beyond these two functions, there is nothing else government should do except to get the hell out and stay out of monetary and economic affairs. Now here comes a shocking question. I hope it shocks you. And it's as follows. Would a fully convertible, honest currency and an equitable tax system, if such an animal exists, would that be of help? And the answer is yes, it would be of help. However, think of this. A sound monetary system and an equitable taxation system are merely necessary conditions for a growing economy, but are not by themselves sufficient conditions. Because unless you are free to create, produce, and trade values, the best currency and the best tax system in the universe will not do any of us any good. Freedom comes first. So we have to start to begin the job of reconstruction by removing all government-created obstacles to the production of goods and services. In this regard, I bring your attention to that last slide, slide number 4 again. And those of you who remember your freshman calculus will recall that the limit of any ratio whose numerator is constant and whose denominator approaches infinity is zero. What this means in English is that if the money supply is kept constant, or at least if its rate of growth is kept constant, as Milton Friedman has insisted many times, and if, moreover, we are free to produce and to trade, then people like us, you and me, we can increase that denominator. We can increase the supply of goods and services and bring the price level down. And inflation is not going to be cured by Canberra or Washington or London or Paris. They are the ones who fucked us up in the first place. We can make prices go down because the human capacity to acquire, use, and increase knowledge is virtually infinite. Unless you are a dialectical materialist, you will know, therefore, that there are virtually no limits to the amount of wealth that a free people can create. Now, in America, in theory, if not in practice, we are a free people. So are you in Australia. Freedom is our ability to respond to the facts of reality, and this is why a man is held responsible for his actions, and this is why any surrender of responsibility is a surrender of freedom. The absence of responsibility is neither a socialist utopia nor a Marxist heaven. It's dependence, it is slavery, it is physical death, it is spiritual death. So if it's true that each one of us is the master of his own destiny, the only choice, really, we have to cure a lot of these problems is whether we want to be free or whether we want to be slaves. Thank you very much. Now the floor is open to questions. I hope to answer.
Like to ask some questions.
Not knowing what in particular bothers an Australian audience, of course, I have to make this quite general, but we can get to specifics. One thing I want to touch on was the latest proposal by Henry Kissinger at the UNESCO meeting of the UN in Nairobi in late May of this year. Whatever bothers you, I'll try to answer it. But remember, I'm only the editor of Mining Engineering. Therefore, I cannot claim omniscience. I could claim omniscience if I were the editor of the New York Times, but I'm not. So I might be unable to answer some of your questions.
Jim and I'd like to ask Mr. Bencarney how America succeeded in keeping the price of gold at $35 per fine ounce over such a long period and then succeeded in demonetizing gold.
And how they were able to do that?
Yes, how they were able to retain it at $35 an ounce for such a long period, and then eventually succeed in demonetizing gold.
When the Depression came in, Corporation, incidentally, was ushered in by a great mining engineer, Wood Berserk, when he became president of the United States, namely Herbert Hoover, who was the spiritual father of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, because every policy that was begun by Herbert Hoover was carried to its logical conclusion by Franklin Delano Roosevelt. There was pretty much what we have today, a liquidity shortage. Where is the real money? That was the paradox. They were drowning in the sea of liquidity. At the same time, there was no capital available for anything. So they had to change the official price of gold from $20 an ounce to $35 an ounce. Well, how do you do it? Very simple. If you have the monopolistic power or force, you retire all the gold from the hands of the people, and you give them pieces of paper in return. In doing that, the U.S. government automatically had a profit of $2.8 billion. It isn't much. It only accounts for about 36 hours of government expenditures of the rate which we're doing today. But anyhow, that was a big problem. Now, the reason why gold, the price of gold, was kept at $35 an hour, that has to be found in the Bretton Woods Conference of 1944, when under the direction of John Maynard Keynes and other people, they had to establish an international monetary system which was based on gold. The dollar was convertible into gold, and every other currency was based on... I'm sorry, I have to go into all this thing, but this is the background for people who might know it. And every other currency was tied to the dollar in turn. And convertibility prevented all of these suspicions that you have had since the gold window was closed by Nixon on August 15, 1971. Since then, we have had floating exchange rates. Well, we have had floating exchange rates because money, in addition to being a store of value, at least this is what it used to be, and a medium for exchange, also serves the scientific purpose of measuring the worth of goods and services. Because if you can't measure the worth of goods and services, you can't exchange them, you can't even barter them across time and space. So, all the governments had no alternative, now that there was no floor anymore under the dollar, but to go into floating exchange rates, in order to find out exactly what the hell their own money was worth, what the market decided their money was worth. Now, the reason why the Treasury Department in Washington keeps stocking down gold is that the only supported currency in the world today is the U.S. dollar. This is how most international deals are denominated. The only competition to the dollar is gold. That's the only competitor. So it is in the interest of the Treasury Department to talk down gold. So, you talk down gold, you say it's a barbarous relic, it's no good for anything. The suckers get scared, they unload their stuff, the price of the damn metal goes down. When it goes down to the point at which William Simon thinks is advisable, then what you will see is a second version, this is my opinion, a second version of the Bretton Woods Agreement. The dollar will be pegged again to gold because there is no way out of it, and all other currencies will be pegged on fixed rates to the dollar, and we will see the same kind of rip-off that we saw in 1934, where gold is going to be called in and new paper is going to be issued out.